Legends, the greatest social casino experience has arrived at Legends.com. With thousands of the best free-to-play casino-style games, chances to earn millions of bonus coins and win real money. Legends is revolutionizing the Vegas experience wherever you are. If you love winning, then you'll love playing at Legends.com. Legends is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Play responsibly. Visit Legends.com for more information. Legends with a Z.com is legendary fun.
Hello and welcome to episode 174 of What Most People Think. And we are the World Cup. The World Cup has started. And you know, like all football fans, I'm really glad that we're in deep discussing the death of migrant workers, you know, international corrupt trade deals between Qatar and other countries, LGBT rights. I mean, it's just great to get back to the football, isn't it? But we will be speaking about that later in the show, because I've got a brilliant guest this week. Returning to the show is Al Murray, the pub landlord. He's also Al Murray, and that's his name. He's just such a great guy to talk to. So, of course, I scratched his brain. That's not even a phrase, is it? Picked his brain about topical issues such as, you know, the Harry Kane incident. I mean, I think I mentioned it in the chat with Al, but for this to fall on Harry Kane is just, I mean, it's a serious thing, but it's also fucking hilarious that a guy that can barely articulate himself suddenly finds himself at the centre of this civil rights issue. It's just, you just look into Harry Kane's eyes and you go, I don't think this guy has the mental faculties to kind of talk his way out of this one. But we speak about the World Cup. We also speak about Brexit. There's been a sort of rise in the discussion about potentially having a different deal with Europe and a Swiss-style deal, or, you know, and got lots of holes in it. That was a cheese gag. Didn't really work. I promise the interview is better than that. So we speak about that. And then we also speak about Al's brilliant new book called Command, which is about the sort of generals and personalities that helped change the course of the Second World War. And listen, I know loads of people of all genders and ages are into the Second World War, but let's be honest, a bloke my age, in and around my age, blokes like us, I mean, it is absolute fucking catnip, isn't it? The Second World War. There's two things I never want to stop hearing about: cricket, Star Wars, tits, God, that was childish, and the Second World War. I mean, and also, it didn't really make sense hearing about tits. I don't know. Seeing them is definitely better. But anyway, so we're going to crack on because it's such a good interview. I want to make as much time for it in the show as possible. David Domain talking point from last week. So the show went up last week late. I don't know if you guys have downloaded it yet. Episode 173. We catch up on a lot of political stuff, but we also have a half hour section on it for the Man Whisperer. And David says, I hope you're keeping well. It's nice to hear the Man Whisperer back on the podcast. For what it's worth, I enjoy these episodes. I think those that moan about them might be able to benefit from the Man Whisperer's advice. Yeah, I mean, I hope it didn't put you off seeing that, because I know that we spoke about kind of mental health the other week. But the chat I have with Kenny is so accessible. And I think some of the best jokes that I've done over the last few weeks were Kenny making grown-up, serious philosophical points, and then me making knob gags. If you're into that, if that's the way you like to get your kind of like counselling, then do go back and have a listen to episode 173. In terms of new Patreons, so just a reminder, board level members, you and people that signed up for the Jeff Norcott and Friends gigs, 25th of January and 2nd of March, I have a list of your names and I hope to be getting them. I'm going to try and get those to you by the end of next week to just give you an idea of what happens next. Of course, you're free to go and buy tickets for that. And then also board level members, your gift, as I've said, I think I said last week, it's being processed, it's arrived, and it will start being dispatched, and that I hope to get to you before Christmas. So the benefits keep coming. And then for all Patreons, I mean, obviously for VIPs, when we do the online show mid-January, still pinning down a date for that, you'll have guaranteed front row access if you wish to have it. And then all patrons will have access to view the gig. I just got to say, fair play to David Smith. I said last week about one of the benefits of patrons, and I said, don't send me dick pics. And he sent me pics of dicks, but they were like, I think, Dick Cheney, Richard Nixon. So childish, but worth it. New patrons we've got. We've got Dan R. You just sound like one of those guys in his late 30s. Maybe works in marketing in Shoreditch, rides around on a tiny little tricycle. Dan R. Yeah, Dan R. Yeah, what's your surname? Don't worry about that. People just call me Dan R. Dan, when you say people, do you mean only you? Yeah, I'm Dan R. Wear a beanie hat. Why are you wearing a beanie hat, Dan? I'm just Dan R. Just, you know, very multicultural. You know, I never eat off plates. I haven't eaten off a plate since 2011. I only eat off like slates or chipboard. welcome, Dan R. We've got Janet Jackson. Fuck off. Your name's not. Well, I guess that is quite a probable or possible name. Janet Jackson. I mean, it's a cool name. Janet Jackson. How's it been for you, Janet Jackson? I mean, because Janet Jackson, I mean, something about having a noncy brother that really has affected her career, must be said. And then her tit popped out, didn't it, at the Super Bowl. I don't know, if you think like the things involving celebrities now, I don't know why that affected her career so much. It's like, okay, it's a weird family, allegations of nonsense, a fucking nipple on I tell you, I never want to see that woman. Do not darken my television again. Underrated Janet Jackson, though. Rhythm Nation was an absolute banger. God, I can't really say words like that, can I? It was a very good song. And then we got Bill Trulove. Bill Trulove. That, you know, it's such a cool name because it does things that good names often do, which is it combines the everyday with the exotic. Bill, I mean, Bill's your mate, isn't he? Bill the Butcher, Bill Trulove. What? This guy's a fucking enigma wrapped in a riddle, isn't he? I remember I dated a girl briefly called Dominique Smith. She had like a French first name, but she was called Smith. It's fucking... I dated her. I think I snogged her twice. I think I saw it as more of a relationship than she did. Okay, let's do a thank you and a fuck you. The thank you is to audiences for being so cool. I mean, as much as the online social media environment is just full of shit and nonsense the whole time, you do a gig and you're reminded that people are and have always been cool. I did a gig in Spalding last Saturday and there was a woman in the audience, right? I mean, that for anyone who knows comedy, that is where this story starts to go. Not the women shouldn't be at comedy, but there was a woman in italics in the audience, a little bit of a white wine werewolf. She was a bit drunk. And the problem is, and people who've never been to comedy find this hard to credit, but women are much more problematic more often in comedy because the blokes, right, mostly they'll try and take the piss. You put them down, they take their medicine, they shut up. Once every 3 years, one of them will throw a pint glass at your head, but the frequency within that is very limited. But a woman, if like she says something, you insult her. She doesn't care that there are 300 people in that room. It's just you and her in the room. Everything else falls away and she's just not having it. No one speaks to her like that, right? And this woman, she was rude to the compere. I think he was from Macedonia and, you know, obviously spoke great English. I mean, he's doing comedy in the UK, very good comic. And she said something like, your English is shit. But, I mean, that's obviously a really unpleasant thing to say anyway. But the irony was it wasn't and hers was. She went, shit. English is shit. I would just say, you know, being a Brit generally, even if I wasn't completely sozzled and speaking in sort of incoherently, speaking other languages is not a strong area for us historically. Can we just say that? I'd just tiptoe around that little one. It's like, you know, where we get our stuff from in museums. You just think, well, let's just not go near that subject. And so he dealt with her, and then I went on, and she was still popping off, you know. Like, you mention a subject, like I mentioned a subject about me not doing enough housework, and obviously as a comic, the way I'm going to treat that subject is I'm going to deal with my own laziness. But she's used to doing more. Yeah, that might be the point of the routine, love. And then I mentioned boob jobs, and she said something about boob jobs, and I just said, I hope you have one, and that they're so big they suffocate you to death. And it's just, I mean, and everyone cheered. What a brilliant thing in comedy that you can say that and then people cheer. I mean, it's like those Twitter things or the social media things where they say I was in a Starbucks and I had an argument with a stranger and I said, trans rights are everybody's rights, and everybody cheered. You go, well, that didn't happen. In comedy, it does happen. And it's just a beautiful reminder that most people are grown-ups who like a laugh. And the fuck you is to all these lefty types on Twitter. And sorry for making this Twitter-centric, but I think that it is interesting. Is ever since Elon Musk bought the website... He's well, frankly, just gone, you know, he's gone in very toxic in that he wants his employees, you know, especially the ones on six-figure salaries, to do stuff and maybe to pay for their lunch. And the way this has played out, online is astonishing. You'd think that the geezer was putting him in those old slave ships, you know, the long boats with the massive oars where they'd be, oh, evil. Like, he's just asking them and to come into the office twice a week. instead of once a month, and to pay for the fucking lunch. And this is what reminds me, there are people on certainly the social media online left that genuinely seem to think that Twitter should be like some sort of national utility. It doesn't matter if it's making losses. Well, how can something be that massive and make a loss? And, you know, some of the hypocrisies come into view recently whereby, you know, Trump got banned for Twitter after January the 6th. And a lot of the discussion then, you know, should that be able to happen? A former president being banned from such a huge social media space, and particularly when it turned out the Taliban had an account. But, you know, a lot of the lefties there, they were just hiding behind the idea of, it's a private company. You know, it's just a private company. They can do it. I remember that argument being used when, you know, social clubs back in the day wouldn't let in people who weren't white or women. It's just a private company. It's a way of saying I don't wish to have this discussion because it's tricky. Now Trump's been allowed back on. Well, guys, it's just a private company. They can do what they want. They can have Kanye back. They can have Trump back. It's like we're getting the old band of Nutters back together. Okay, let's crack on with the main bit of this show, which is the welcome return of Al Murray, otherwise known as the Pub Lord Al Murray. But now, an author of a fantastic new book called Command. I'll speak to him about that. But first off, we start with a little bit of politics. I'll just nick Ben Elton's catchphrase then. Okay, making a welcome return to the show. Well, I mean, I'd say welcome for me. I don't know about Al Murray. He's been doing podcasts all morning, but welcome back, Al.
Thanks, Jeff. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, I mean, you are here, obviously. You've got this book out, which is called Command. And I can say with absolute sincerity that about 20 pages in, I went on Amazon and ordered it for a family member because I thought, yeah. You know, with a book, not enough is said about books, about how many decisions you make early on, right? Are you like that if you're reading a book? First 50 pages, what does it take?
Yeah. Very often, just the sort of introduction, you go, yeah, I know he'll like this.
Yeah. But on a personal level, I mean, have you ever not finished a book? I mean, what does it take for you to buy a book? Is it cover, first five pages and blurb?
Sometimes it'll be a review. It's usually word of mouth. Or sometimes it'll be like, it's a thing I know, because I do all this, so much history stuff. I think I know I need to read about. So I'll have a look at what's available and plump for one. But I do not finish a lot of books. I've got an awful lot of books I have not finished. And I tend to, you know, I'll pull the bit out that I need if I'm trying to put an idea together. But there are lots of books and books I ought to have finished that I haven't finished. And then there's a whole lot of books I never, ever will read. Like you're not going to see me on a lounge with Jane Austen. That is not going to happen.
I'm just picturing the physical manifestation of that. You and Jane Austen. That was the book that she never wrote, wasn't it? A Dirty Weekend Away with a Pub Landlord. I like the idea also.
Pints and Prejudice, yeah.
It's a great book, and we will come on to it. I mean, just as a sort of teaser, the one thing I love about it is, I think we spoke about this last time you were on, is about hitting that age where all you really ever want to read about is the Second World War. And there was this phrase, what was it about, a peelable onion? There was something,
you can't peel the onion. You just can't get to, you'll never get to the centre of the onion of the Second World War. Just the more you peel it, the bigger the onion gets. It's amazing. It's an incredible topic.
Well, it sounds also a bit like a weird fever dream, but in this context, I think that in terms of creating content, thank God, as I've said it before, thank God for Hitler. I mean, the amount of content we need to... Someone put up a statue. Let's get...
Well, then we'd have to... then we'd have to throw it into a water feature, wouldn't we? I think maybe people would like to throw a statue of Hitler into the canal. That's a reason for putting a Hitler statue up. That's a thought experiment.
No, I do wonder about that. There's a lot of, you know, there's been a lot of talk about Twitter at the moment and left-wing people sort of deserting it. And I'm going, you all realise that this is Batman versus the Joker, right? We all sort of need each other. And are we actually robbing future woke generations or progressive generations of the statues to throw away? This is incredibly selfish.
Yeah, or make statues out of cork. So that they float and then you can fish it back out and do it again, you know. I mean, so many things in life you only do once, don't you? Now they've pushed that cost. Now the cost of touch has gone in the water. Can't do it again, can they?
No, no. Charge for it. Monetize. That's what we need to do. We're in economic trouble.
You're such a Tory.
speaking of economic cynicism, the World Cup, I mean, I don't know if you're bang into it, but I don't know if at this point you really need to be to know the issues. We're talking the day after. I mean, this does sound weird, doesn't it? The day after Harry Kane didn't wear an armband. And I've got to say, of all the people in history that it fell upon to make a moral stance, Harry Kane didn't sort of scream out as being the guy, did he?
Well, and then the Iranian team didn't sing their national anthem, and they'll be in a lot more trouble for that, I imagine.
Yeah,
you know, than maybe getting a yellow. I mean, the thing is, the truth is the World Cup in Russia was should have been just as knotty with these same issues, but you know, the social discourse in this country hadn't arrived at that point yet, hadn't quite got there yet. You've also got that prevarication on the in bits of the left about Russia, because they think, some of them think it's still the Soviet Union, so they can't bring themselves to do it. You know, like it's Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact all over again. You've got that, but you know, by the World Cup in Russia, they'd invaded Ukraine, hadn't they? You know, they'd already taken the Crimea, the Russians. So, well, hold on a minute. You know, and I think there's obviously been an interesting, dispassionately, it's interesting, shift in people in the discourse and their involvement in it that wasn't present during the World Cup in Russia. This is what World Cups are like. I always think when you've got the UN and Iran is chair of the Human Rights Commission, and people go, how can this possibly happen? Well, that's because that's what the world's like. There's an ideal world, and then there's the world that we actually live in, which is the one we need to sort out rather than the ideal world. You need to the world that maybe you need to address is the one that exists.
Yeah.
And the UN holds up this horrendous mirror that means that you get Iran in charge of women's rights for 6 months a year or whatever. You know what I mean?
But called the United Nations, and it's actually a place for people to meet up, disagree and walk out
shapes at each other about stuff. Yeah, yeah. For public consumption at home, generally. So I mean, it's, you know, I think it's interesting that the World Cup, you know, after all, I'm not really a football person. And the point of football, as far as I can tell, for blokes, is it means they can talk to each other without having to talk about anything else.
Yep.
So they don't have to talk about their feelings. They don't have to talk about politics, religion, their wives, their families, how shit their job is, whatever. They could talk about Arsenal, Chelsea, and the gap is filled. The void
is filled.
But somehow
this World Cup has made us talk about all those things, about women's rights, jobs, migrant workers.
But that just shows there's some sort of football malfunction occurring.
Yeah.
You know, football isn't enough. Or is being elbowed away from its actual function, which is to blot out those other things. I think, you know, that's interesting in itself, but I mean...
It is. I mean, into this political maelstrom steps Harry Kane. And I just, I mean, like, I don't want to knock his oratory skills, but he's no Harvey Milk, is he? I mean, if this thing came out was they didn't want it to be... to get, you know, because there might be bookings that would mean they were suspended for the first knockout stage. And I honestly thought, yeah, okay, I get that that's what you would tell the public. And then Harry Kane gives an interview going, no, that really is the reason. I was going, dude, say something else. Say that someone visited your hotel room later. Not, well, you probably couldn't say that. I mean, that's also dodgy, but.
I mean, it is peculiar, though, because... I don't know. Like I say, in Russia, we weren't talking about this, but there wasn't the discourse wasn't at the point where you had to wear an armband and all that hadn't got there yet. You know, I think we were still fighting poppy wars with Irish footballers in the great poppy wars.
Yeah, you know, we hadn't taken any knees yet. Yeah, I mean,
No. The knee had not been taken. But again, you think what's going on in Iran? Right, which is of a completely different order, and where the stakes are so much higher over things that we think are much more sort of rudimentary rights. You know, what women can wear. You know, I think it also makes it all look, without being my dad, all a bit trivial.
You know. Yeah, I mean, and also the nature of the protest, what I was sort of thinking was, okay, if there's this argument, look, we're having it in Qatar, they have a different set of cultural, political, legal values, we should respect that. Go, okay, I think you should still be able to wear a thing that indicates what you think. Well, it doesn't seem like a great leap.
Our traditions, currently, our traditions of wearing armbands, they should respect our traditions.
Mm.
We've got to go there and respect their traditions. They
yeah, we respect the law. Can we just wear a fucking armband? It's not like Harry Maguire and Jordan Pickford are going to be copping hold of each other just outside the centre circle. It wasn't. And what were the potential consequences? Are they going to bang up Harry Kane? I don't think.
Well, I mean, that
is a move, isn't it? I don't think they're ready to make that move, are they?
Yeah, I don't think. You know the the Qatar Hilton or whatever the prison's known as. The thing is though, I've also met, in recent weeks, people who are not talking about the World Cup like this at all, right? They are not having this conversation. Can't wait to go. It's going to be brilliant. I've got tickets for 10 games. Can't wait. I just got allotted them. I don't care what they are, but I've managed to cop England, Wales. That's brilliant. I'm looking forward to it. It's really exciting. And that is the extent of their, conversation about the World Cup. Another friend of mine he's going to be going out, and, you know, for later once the heats are out of the way, these rounds are out of the way. Yeah, can't wait. It's going to be brilliant. Love it. World Cup. Love the football. World Cups are good, you see, Al. That's the thing. And you're like, and he is not engaged in the... These guys are not engaged
in the discourse. Yeah, I mean, I think you're right.
Because football for them is performing its function. It's blotting it.
And it's also happening. And this is where I think the World Cup could grow in popularity. I mean, I'll be honest. The first goal went in, I was like, and yet I still feel like we're losing. Fourth goal went in, I was like, England! You know, I'd certainly change my mood a little bit. And it is a World Cup happening in the sort of bleak recesses of November. It's a shitty bit of the year, isn't it?
Yeah.
Halloween's gone. Guy Fawkes Night's gone. It's a while till Christmas. So you know, and there's a result today. You know, it's involving Saudi Arabia and Argentina. That's the kind of result that drags people in. So maybe you're right, is actually what most people think, really, in the real world, is that, well, yeah, they probably should have worn it, but probably let's crack on with the tournament. That probably is the predominant view.
I mean, what's interesting, though, is that you know, this has been coming a while off this World Cup. When did Qatar win the bid? And yet it seems that the people around the England team are still making up their minds on the hoof, that they didn't work out what they were going to do. And I think it's also interesting, you know, you could argue that the European nations where wearing the armband is a cool thing to do could have all gone to FIFA and gone, we're all going to wear it, by the way. What are you going to do? Kick out Germany, France, Italy.
Well, absolutely.
And Italy aren't in it. But, you know, kick us all out, then you haven't got a tournament. I mean, it's the sort of, it's the spinelessness. Given, if they'd thrown the tournament together last week and this was the England establishment reacting to what's going on, fine for being a bit headless about the whole thing. But this is, you know, this has been in the diary for years.
And the One Love initiative came from football. This isn't something that has been pitched to football. They've made, and this is where it perhaps sticks in the craw for people, is that football has recently transitioned. I'm just throwing buzzwords in. Hasn't transitioned, you know, but it's become a sort of vehicle for social justice. So that's the problem, isn't it? And then from my point of view, if you essentially take in the knee, which is indexed to race relations, are you then saying, well, we can do that because they'll let us, but, you know, another group of society, we won't do that because...
They won't let us.
They won't...
They won't let us.
I mean, can you imagine some of the other great moments like Rosa Parks going, well, I'm not sitting in the front of a bus, they might invalidate my travel card. I mean...
Well, it's kind of... The thing is, in politics, we've got cakeism, haven't we? It's been one of the big things that's been kicked around is the idea of cakeism. And it's a little bit like there's been some cakeism in football. And now actually you're not allowed to do the thing. Oh, well, we won't have our cake. The minute there's any pushback, because there was going to be proper pushback here. People being rude on Twitter isn't pushback. Being told you might, get a yellow card and not make the next round, that's pushback, isn't it, within football?
Yeah, I would imagine that the organisers of FIFA were probably going, Jesus, I didn't think that was... I would imagine that they would have thought that there was a second chapter in that. And who knows, there might be. The England team might...
Well, there may be. It may be that there's a decision to sort of... I mean, you know, uh, uh, to you could say grow a spine, but I just don't know, because the thing is football is so evidently totally bent, right? Mm. And this is me speaking. I'm not into football, so I think I can say that because I'm outside it. It doesn't matter to me. I don't wake up at night worrying about Brentford, you know. I mean, there are people that do that, I understand. But you know what I mean? So it doesn't affect me to go, well, the whole thing's entirely bent and polluted with cash and distorted by the money. It doesn't feel like a difficult thing for me to say. So to see it play out like this isn't particularly surprising.
I mean,
and, you know, cynicism, this the whole thing's drenched in cynicism, isn't it, basically, on all sides?
Well, like I say, you know, these podcasts stick around for a while. By the time people listen to this, Harry Kane may still be languishing in a Qatari prison for crimes against the state, sort of becoming a weird LGBT Nelson Mandela. You mentioned politics there. Let's have a quick chat about that. I just want to pick your brain a little bit, because I think you are very fair politically. One of the rare sort of comedians that's able to view things reasonably objectively. And lately, you know, in the face of undeniable economic drag from Brexit, other things, but, you know, it's there.
Yeah.
We've seen the resurgence of talk of a Swiss-style deal. We haven't had this for a while, style deals. Remember Canada Plus? Remember that?
And Britzeland is what Boris at one point was saying in the run-up to... Before he was prime minister, you know, and actually the buck stopped with him. Yeah, I mean,
only Boris could come up with a thing that a TV producer would suggest just because it had a good name.
Yeah, I mean, he's good at he was good at that, wasn't he? That was the thing he was good at.
Yeah. he could have definitely been an AP on a light ends format. But I mean, it is interesting. I mean, I think, you know, as someone that voted Leave but wasn't really an ideological Brexiteer, is that with the Eurozone going into recession with us next year, you know, contracted, I think more cooperation is an absolute piece of low-hanging fruit, isn't it?
Well, you could argue that the very first thing that the British government should have done the day after the Brexit referendum was like the big embassy in Brussels to try and figure out what was going to happen next and to make sweet love to everyone in Brussels, because it was going to get difficult after that. Because, you know, you exit a thing, you've got to figure out how you're exiting. I think one of the things that's happened, basically, is that if you and I don't subscribe to that, because I mean, one of the things I think that's remarkable about the referendum result was, after so many years of quite a lot of poor coverage for the EU, that it was as close as it was. I think it's really 52-48 is close, right? And given that if you read British newspapers for the last 40 years, you would have been fairly certain that the EU was a terrible thing, right? So why was it so close? I don't know, right? But that's striking in itself, right? But I think what, you know, and the problem is, I think the fundamental problem is, and the Truss government, the Truss people, they went in the open with this, where they wanted to go Singapore on Thames, you know, cut taxes and all that stuff, right? Is that they finally said what it was that they wanted out of Brexit, finally said it out loud. Whereas what you'd had, and in the Brexit vote, you know, more money for the NHS on the, and I don't like the whole thing about the thinking math, right? But more money for the NHS, more control in your life, so a better relationship with your local politicians. And so essentially, I can see why people voted for what sounds like social democracy, which is more money for the NHS and better democratic involvement with the government, which is what the Leave pitch in public was in fact an awful lot of Leave people who were saying that, because what they wanted was Singapore on Thames, right? And so that's that, you know, there's no mystery as to why red wall people voted for Brexit, because if it's about spending, you know, what's the thing that Blairites used to say is it was about, you know, more money for the NHS, more money for nurses, hang the pedos, was basically the sort of triangulation, you know, it's not
law and order, you know, strong defence, right? Strong defence spending.
There is, right? And I think you, if you look at Brexit through that prism, you can see why people voted for it, right? But that's also why, if you're still trying to deliver it, and you're still hung up on if you're the ERG, for instance, still hung up on questions of sovereignty and trade deals and not wanting to do deals with anyone, which in the end seems to me like... really unrealistic, really, really, fundamentally unrealistic. And also, what's sovereignty for if it's not for using? And you use your sovereignty to do deals with people because you've got the ability to do those deals. It's just sort of, I've got a bit of material in my show at the moment where I do a whole thing about Brexit, and the pub landlord's disappointed in Brexit. And the reason he's disappointed is because we can't do it again, because it felt so good. It felt so good that morning to wake up and say we'd done it, right? And we can't do it again, right?
Yeah.
And I get the feeling there are people in the sort of Brexity bit of parliamentary politics, because after all, this was a parliamentary politics question that then got put to everyone through a referendum. That their annoyance is they can't do it again.
Best bit of their lives. Bit of their lives are like, you know, being at summer camp in teens and staying up late, getting drunk. And it was Christmas Eve, wasn't it? The day that the vote landed was Christmas Eve, and the rest of it was Christmas Day, which is always a disappointment.
Well, now it's December the 30th or something, right? And, you know, or the 29th, you're right in the bars. But the thing is I think there's a whole load of them. They just want to do it again. So when the idea of Switzerland came up, got floated lightly this week, no, we can't do that. Because they just want to do it again and again and again and prolong the feeling. Whereas, in fact, at some point, we've got to seriously address what we're going to do about the enormous market that's on our doorstep that just geographically is only 20 miles away.
And the same, I think the same for the EU to a point, because the luxury of the macho posturing is kind of like COVID's washed that away a little bit. I mean, I think that, you know, the polls have moved quite decisively in one direction for now. But there is this, you know, it is only 36 months since we properly left. I just have a bit of an issue with, if you go, all right, well, people have changed their mind now, let's have another referendum. Yeah. And then when they change their mind again, let's have one. Then let's just hokey-cokey the fuck out of this.
But parliamentary politics, no parliament's bound by a prior parliament. It's interesting that referendums somehow sit extra-parliamentary in our conception of that. I think that's what's interesting is that, you know, although, as we all know, in our the consensus that still exists, I mean, I think one of the things that's really interesting when people talk about politics, when they talk about Tory plans for the NHS, they want to destroy it. Well, they're taking their sweet time over it, selling it off and dismantling it completely. No parliamentary party in this country could stand up and say we're abolishing the NHS 1st January and expect to win a single seat.
No, electoral suicide. We can't even, if you think about things that are guaranteed vote losers, neither of the parties are even willing to look at the triple lock and the fact that a quarter of pensioners are living in households of net worth of over $1 million. Neither of them are going to do it. But I mean, it is. I've always thought that with the Tories destroying the NHS, do you remember the old Batman shows with Adam West? Is this the end for our caped crusader at the end of every episode? You go, well, obviously not. They've just commissioned another series.
Well, and you know, although it was baloney, all that talk of going to build 50 hospitals, whatever it was, you know, that was Boris looking for people's funny bone. He wasn't saying we're going to shut 50 hospitals because I hate the NHS because I'm an evil Tory, right? I mean, you know, he was many things, but he wasn't that stupid.
Okay, I hope you're enjoying the chat with Al there. And I hope what you're hearing in this podcast is the beauty. Can you hear it? It's the beautiful sound of no adverts. Now, I know almost every single podcast you listen to will have advertising on now. I have just chosen not to go that way. And look, you know, I don't know how my agent truly feels about that, but I like it. I like it like this. I'd like to stay this way. Obviously, there is pressure from me as the podcast grows bit by bit in audience, but I think it's a cool way to do it that I don't suddenly have to go, oh, you know when you're sort of sitting and working from home, sometimes you get piles. I tell you something, guys. The new the Pattinson pile driver, which is a new pillow from Pattinson. It's just, I don't know, it's just the best pile cushion I've ever had. And look, I mean, look, this is an advert, but I'm being genuine here. The Pattinson pile driver, I mean, I know this sounds like a slogan, but it certainly drove away my piles. Live gigs next year. Look out for tour dates. I'm in discussion about the tour. You can also sign up to the mailing list. I think if you're on iTunes, it is in the details. So I understand if finances are tricky and the Patreon isn't a thing you can do. But if you just go, or if you look at the podcast details at the bottom, there should be links and there's a mailing list. And if you sign up to that, you'll get first news on tour stuff. You'll also get access to watch, I think, my 2018 tour show. And that way, if Twitter does fucking collapse under the weight of trying to make any money, I can still tell you when I'm going to be doing gigs. All right, let's get back to the chat with Al. So, your book, Command, how long has it been out?
Came out in mid-October, second week of October. Yeah, so sort of 6 weeks, 5 weeks.
And given it's a military thing, and without, I've just realised I'm about to sound like a local radio DJ, but what I actually wrote this question now. What, describe the mission of the book, the mission.
Ah, well, it's simple, really. Yeah. The Second World War, when you look at it, it's an amazing, there is a simple, amazing story, which is the Allies and principally Britain to start with, because the American situation is a little bit different, but it sort of happens to them in the Far East as well, are crap, really, really, really bad, and get off to an appalling start, right? And somehow, you know, when you consider what, you know, Dunkirk, what happened to Dunkirk is masked by the miracle of Dunkirk, with the evacuation with the little boats, although it's mainly the Navy off the mole at Dunkirk, blah, 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 all that sort of qualifications, historical qualifications. But the reason that you've got to have the miracle of Dunkirk is because the British Army has made such an horrendous mess of things, and the French Army has too, that they're being expelled from Northwest Europe, right? It's an ignominious defeat of the highest order. And 4 years, only 4 years later, you know, so 2018 to now, only 4 years later, D-Day happens. The Allies invade Northwest Europe. And the British Army by that point is this sort of all-consuming, crushing war machine that is also brilliant at learning from its mistakes and course correcting and outthinking the enemy and how the hell does that happen? Because 4 years earlier, they basically can't tie their own bootlaces, and they can't in 1941 either, and they can't in 1942. It's not till the end of 42 that things start to turn around in the Western theater. Then in the Eastern theater, it's not until 1944 that the British get their act together. How the hell does that happen? Especially as we're so down on our institutions now, the way we view our institutions now, how on earth is that? How do you do that?
Yeah, how do you turn a failing thing around? There was something that you said in the book which I thought was interesting. You characterise the complacency going into the war. So was complacency about sort of Germany's ambition or ability to counteract if they were to attack?
Both. It's a complete lack of basically. I mean, what's interesting is the Chamberlain government, you know, appeasement. It's famous for its appeasement of Germany's foreign policy ambitions. But it's kind of constrained by the fact that Germany, to start with, is saying, well, that bit of Austria's Germany, really. You all know that. Come on, let's admit it. And the Austrians want to be part of Germany, too. Come on, that bit of Czechoslovakia, that's German, really. Come on, you know, you all know that. And post-League of Nations, self-determination of peoples, you can't really argue. And there's enough inertia in the British political establishment to go, you know what, we can't really argue with that. He's got a point, right? Mm. And then after Czechoslovakia, where Chamberlain is essentially made a fool of in public, he's got rearmament going properly. And the British economy is run on this basis from 37 through to 39, where you're trying to rearm as much as you can without just bending the economy out of shape, not overheating it and taking engineers out of consumer goods and all that sort of stuff. So this is an attempt to deter the Germans, not actually to fight a war with them. So to go, look, you come and have a go if you think you're hard enough. And then the Germans do a thing that means there's a war. So the British establishment is confident enough to declare war in 1939, but it has absolutely no idea what it's letting itself in for. How serious the Germans are, and the Germans are often credited with having done all their thinking, but what they've actually done is mobilised their population really, really successfully. And in the end, it comes down to mobilising. If you want to fight, it's about mobilising people. And we're seeing this right now, where it appears that the Russians aren't very good at mobilising their soldiers, whereas the Ukrainians are very, very good at it. And are also on the receiving end of Lend-Lease, like we were in the Second World War. Lots of kit coming from America to kit them out. They're very well mobilised. They've got the shit together in terms of, it appears, tactically and strategically, so they know what they're doing.
And they're double-hard bastards, can we just say that? It certainly appears. Yeah, yeah, yeah. I don't know if that's the military term for it. But,
oh, no, it absolutely is. But it's also that thing of, you know, there's one way to make people feel Ukrainian, I imagine. It's invade Ukraine, you know. If you want to galvanise people. I mean, it's like the Blitz. It becomes – what's very interesting about the Blitz, for instance, is I think it's, you know, the Allied bombing of Europe, you know, dwarfs the German bombing of Britain by, you know, by a scale of sort of 40 to 1, something like that. That's a figure plucked out of my hat. I'm sure a listener will correct me.
Yeah, but by the end of the war,
By 1943, you look at what happens in Hamburg in July of 1943, where they kill as many people in Hamburg as are killed in the Blitz in the whole of the Second World War in Britain in one night, right?
Wow.
And you know, so the application of force that the Allies have but basically the start of the war, it's completely complacent. It's like they're also convincing themselves that basically the German generals will go, you know what, this isn't worth it. We're going to lose again because we're taking on Britain and France, two big empires. We're going to lose again. So the British the whole time are expecting the German establishment to collapse and get rid of Hitler. The whole time. And that never ends. During the whole of the Second World War, they're expecting that to happen, that basically the German establishment to come to its senses. And it never happens.
I mean, good thing we didn't do that with Russia and Putin, eh? Eh? He's going to die. they're going to have a coup. They're going to have a putsch.
Oh, God.
Something's going to happen.
No, but it's the same. It's exactly the same thinking. It's the same mentality. Mm. Because after all, what happens is you tend to judge the side by your own values and parameters. So, you know, from our perspective, what Putin's doing is completely irrational. So he's going to stop doing it because it's irrational. And there's that feeling in the British establishment. And certainly the British army in 1939, 1940 is basically has told itself it's ready for this European war. It's not, because what the British army actually is, and here's another parallel with today, is an imperial gendarmerie. Its job is to put out border wars on the Afghan border, or in Africa where there's trouble, or in Malaya if there are rebels. That's its job. So it doesn't have so one of the things the army starts off with is it doesn't have a central doctrine, a way of doing things. That's left to the major general for when he gets to wherever to figure it out when he gets there. And you see that in the pattern of the way Britain fights its wars in the 19th and early 20th century. So the Boer War is a good example where the British get there, they're given a runaround and a real proper kicking. Mm. But because they have the resources and the time, they then figure out how to beat the Boers and crush them.
There's a phrase you used that involved blunder and calamity.
So what you end up with, yes, it's all blunder and calamity, what the British do. But there is a central policy that they've got in mind the whole time, which is a thing called steel, not flesh. And the idea is you're going to use industry and your industrial might to fight the war rather than people. And you're going to keep as many people as you possibly can in your factories and make the stuff to take the war to the enemy rather than get a load of people killed like in the First World War. Because, you know, the British Empire loses 1 million dead in the First World War. It's incredible, you know, they're moving heaven and earth to make sure they don't do that again.
And then, so into this, you sort of place these personalities at the heart of the book. These generals, these people that found unique ways of achieving things. Yeah. One thing that's interesting is you have an ability, and I think that all comedians have this, and certainly the very good ones do, is how do you package an idea and sell it to people? Because that is what we're touting every single time we're up there.
Oh, that's it. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And you use this quote, and I can't remember, sorry, if it was a Spike Milligan quote, which is, if you want the truth, go to a comedian. You know, how much do you think when you're doing these things to do with history and a book, how much does your comic instincts play out? Because, you know, you start with Monty, and that is such a comedian mindset, is right, got to get him on side early doors. Who does everyone know? The Monty fella. And I mean, it's brilliant, the stuff about Monty, but does that inform the way that you come at history?
Absolutely. I mean, the thing is I read an awful lot of history books, like, you know, this office is full of them here, and some of them are very well written. And some of them are not. They have the information I require in them, and they're interesting in them. They're interesting in what they're telling you, but they're not written to be read in an entertaining way at all. And so I very much, very consciously came at this from the point of view of, like, you know, I'm an entertainer, and history is a branch of entertainment. Despite what dusty people might tell you, it is. We are a wing of the entertainment industry, certainly in popular history, certainly Second World War history. You know, that's why you think you're buying this book for someone, you know, because it's entertaining.
It's a great story, well told.
Well, and that's what you know, stand up. The joke, in a way, in stand up, I can write jokes, but it's how you put them across and how you sell them and how you string them together and how you thread the needle and all that. That's the hard part. That's the difficult bit. And one of the things I had to do for this book was come up with a prose style that you know, isn't the pub landlord, you know. It's not like...
No, yeah. I mean, it's really accessible. And also, as a comic, you know that, you know, sometimes a knob gag will engage the masses. And this is not a knob gag as such, but for me... You know, the prevalence of VD in the war, yeah. and the effects. I mean, there was this stat from the First World War. It was that it caused like over 400,000 hospital cases compared to 74,000 trench foot. I mean, and I suppose the interesting thing with Montgomery is how, not is it progressive, how he just accepts that and tries to work within those parameters? Yeah,
he absolutely is. And it's pragmatic, and it's he understands his men. He knows what they're like.
They're perverts, filthy bastards.
He knows what they're going to do, particularly when they're bored. Because the big problem in the autumn of 39 is there's nothing happening. Germans have invaded Poland. The Allies have decided to do nothing about it. So they're all sat there and they're bored. They're bored witless. And he's obviously thinking of the First World War because he was a staff officer in the First World War. So knew what was going on under the bonnet of the army. I mean, the other thing that's interesting about that statistic of the 400,000 men hospitalised, that's the people who admitted to having venereal disease.
Some of them, their knob just fell off and they blamed it on trench foot.
Well, exactly. And
telling their missus, oh, it's the trench foot. It was the trench foot. I swear to God, just fell off one day. As they all spoke in the First World War.
I don't know where my feet have been, yeah, exactly. I put my knob in a trench. But the thing is that there's a lot of debate about those stats about how actually reliable they are for this very reason, you know, because there's another statistics that the Americans do this stuff. They survey their men about fear, right? And how their fear manifests itself and all this sort of stuff. And those surveys are really, really interesting because they're also, you've got to read them in the context of the 1940s when men were men, right? And they're not going to say, I shit myself every time we come under fire. Mm. Whereas that's fairly common, right? Because it's terrifying. Yeah. And so all these stats also in themselves have another story wrapped around them. And the sexually transmitted disease infection rates for Italy at the end of the war are absolutely sky high. And there's a historian who believes that in the Eastern Theatre, in the Pacific Theatre, basically everyone had syphilis. Basically everybody, everyone in the American Navy, Army and Marine Corps, essentially everyone had syphilis.
I mean, you could sort of see why, except the Padre. He had gonorrhea. He had gonorrhea. So it's more noble STD. There's a memorable phrase that's used is horizontal refreshment. Yeah. Is that one of Monty's phrases?
That's Monty's phrase. Yeah. So what I do in the book is I use people to illustrate different phases of the war and when, you know, the corners are turned and all this sort of stuff. And I use Monty in 39 before he's Monty. So when he's Montgomery, he's a major general. He's one of the sort of guys who no one wants to sit next to in the mess because he's going to talk shop, right? He really is that bloke. He's completely obsessed. His wife died in 37 and he becomes completely monomaniac about it. And she was an artist, sort of bohemian, and would put on plays with him and all this sort of stuff and got him out of himself. And then she dies tragically and he like shuts himself down completely, sends his son away to some relatives, shuts himself down, becomes an army man completely. And so in 39, he's given command of 3rd Infantry Division. He's brought back from Palestine. He's given one of the, you know, top divisions to train at command. And he writes in November 1939, he writes a memo to his men, to his officers saying, the men are going to want to have sex. You need to make sure they're clean. You need to send them to the approved brothels. The French police will know. And he uses the expression horizontal refreshment, which I like. I think it's quite good.
It's so British, and it's also like,
you all know what I mean, chaps. It's got that in it, you know.
The old horizontal refreshment. Yeah. Yeah.
And then he also, I think it's quite interesting because then he also added a poem by one of the signal, someone from this, which he says is from the signalers. This poem about the men wanting to have sex. And what's weird about that poem is the poem seems to know what's in Monty's memo. So I have a suspicion that unknowable and unknown this because it's signed anonymous or X. I have a suspicion he wrote that and it's got fruity language in it. But basically what happens is the head chaplain and the head Catholic priest in the British Expeditionary Force demand his resignation. They want him fired for using the expression horizontal refreshment. They think he's gone too far. It's foul language.
Or didn't go far enough. They're like, that's a bit euphemistic, mate. Just go straight banging, hanging out of the back of. Oh, dear. Yeah,
exactly. I mean, and that's what's it's amazing. And he really is one of their best people. He's an unsufferable git, but he really is one of their best people. And that they're prepared to, you know, he has to be rescued. Goes to the adjutant general, who is the guy, who is the person who makes the appointments in the army through all the lobbying. It goes to him to have him fired, which is just amazing. But their attitude to this war is, oh, you know, he said something fruity. So he might be really competent, but he's got to go. And he, fortunately, he's rescued by his corps commander, who's a guy called Alan Brooke, who then ends up chief of the Imperial General Staff in the war, who then acts as a shield for Montgomery for the rest of the war, protects him from controversy for the rest of the war.
I mean, it's interesting, you know, just one last point on this before we move on to a couple of letters from the patrons, is you're reminded of the fame of generals, about how they build profile. There's other people you speak about how they cultivate the media. And it sort of seems odd, but then you think, I mean, Chris Whitty was a meme for saying, next slide, please. So I guess when you're at war, and some of these guys knew how to work the angles, there was was it Ord Wingate, who essentially led a fairly catastrophic failed mission, but worked the angles when he got back, like basically like Alistair Campbell.
Oh, he's amazing. Ord Wingate is absolutely amazing because he's famous. He's the bloke who conceived the Chindits, and it's this thing called long range penetration, which, you know, it's the idea that you send a column of men up a river in Africa, and it's an old imperial technique. You send a load of guys up a river. In a column and take on the enemy where you find them at great distance, and you do it through endurance and toughness. And he was also going to add air supply to that. But Wingate basically was a brilliant networker and a brilliant and absolutely phenomenal salesman. Had the real zeal of a true believer in his own brilliance, right? And so he's able to convince. I mean, he does this first Chindit operation where he's convinced the guy in charge that he can do this thing. And in training his men, invalids, tons of people, because he's training the jungle. The jungle's really bad for you, and loads of people get terribly sick. But he's allowed to do the operation anyway. And he puts the 2,000, he takes a couple of thousand guys into the jungle. At the end of it, he leaves, I think, 600 behind or something, killed and wounded. And then of the men he gets out, and he says, right, I'm off now. Every man for himself, you head home. So it's not great leadership, right? He scarpers back to India. When he gets back, he expects to be court-martialed, right? But is then able to find a couple of journalists and spin it to them that he's struck this amazing blow at the Japanese. He's conquered the jungle, even though 600 of his men are so sick from what's happened to them, they are never able to go into combat again. It's like it's so irresponsible, but he's able to sort of laser lock you, put the head beams on you, and get.
Well, we've worked with comedians on that where we've seen them die on their ass, and then they come back and they do a little bit of green room spin. Yeah, they were nice. They were smiling. They were liking it. If smiling and liking it is good enough. I mean, look, I think that there'll be so many people that will be fired up to get this book, and you know, the way that you spoke about it is such a great representation of how it strikes you. So do get online and buy that, and obviously give it a great review.
Yes, that'd be terrific.
Let's do a couple of letters. So these are from my board level patrons. These are the top tier patrons. And so I put it out there that I had you on the show. I had a lot of responses, but I picked out a couple. One is from this guy. So this one came in a bit late, but I'd really like to get an answer for you on this. This is from a guy called Paul Millman. So he says, you're involved in some kind of competition with him, right? Paul Millman, he says, can you ask Al if enough time has now passed for him to feel able to come out and admit that he cheated me and my team, Pedlo Potemkin, out of a well-deserved victory in the Krispov decider on his show Compete for the Meat. He knows that I ate more crisps than my opponent and that he held a load of hers back in the bag when he tipped them out. I make no suggestion that her being fit had any bearing on his decision to cheat me out of a win, but it does add context. As you can tell, I'm over it and bear no grudge. Cheers. So,
if only there were stewards to have an inquiry.
So is it that this other competitor was an attractive woman, or did you realise that good telly need to be made? What happened
entirely,
here?
It's entirely probable that he was up against an attractive young lady at this juncture. Yes.
See? This is how the healing begins.
But the pub landlord is only flesh and blood, right? He's just a man, and he's weak like everyone else, but in a position of power. So what, you know, you should have eaten your crisps quicker.
You should have eaten your Krispy Kreme, but take some fucking responsibility, Paul. And also, I get the sense that Al Murray sort of apologised, but the pub landlord is completely unrepentant.
No, he can't apologise. Never apologise, never explain.
This is from Kevin Fawn. He just says, I would love to know how you react so quickly when doing audience participation. I'm sure practice comes into it, but do you ever remember a particular time where you've just been stumped? You know, where someone's just said something, I guess it would be, I'm guessing, but something so fucking odd that you just...
Well, no, I tend to, if I do run into something that's basically impossible, I just sort of, I'll do a bit of flubber, then I'll move on. So they don't stick in my head. Because the whole way that works is by pushing it, being relentless. And, you know, if you find a thing you can sit on and have fun with, but then you're relentless with it within that moment. So, no, I can't think of anything that's ever really completely banjaxed it.
Well, what you do get, though, is the guys that think that they're smart that come to be willfully obstructive. So they go, my name's Nobby and I'm a gynecologist.
That's all often boring. What do you do? Bit of this, bit of that. And you think, oh, no. Let's play rather than, you know, because in a way, it's the thing that people say about, you know, improvisation is it's that thing of saying yes and, isn't it? Exactly. And if they block, it's just like, we're not, you know what? This will be a lot more fun if we play rather than get stuck. I mean, I you know, the last gig I did was in, last weekend I was in Dublin. And it's absolutely brilliant, like when people play the ball properly, right? There's a guy who goes, what do you do? He goes, oh, I'm retired. So what do you used to do? So I used to be sergeant in the Irish Army. I'm like, big pause. Pub landlord, oh, I didn't realise there was an Irish Army. Well, apart from the one I've heard of, right? And the whole room. We've managed to get to that subject without having to get to the subject. And then the whole thing unlocked. You know, I go, is that army where the people are in charge of it claim it doesn't even exist, you know, nothing to do with it, and you've not got to say it. And it's when that happens, you're playing together.
Listen, Al, I know that you're a very busy man. It's great to have you back.
Total pleasure, Jeff.
Remind us of the book, where we can get it and where we should be leaving reviews.
It's called Command, How the Allies Learned to Win the Second World War. It's published by Headline, and it's in bookshops. It's online. There's an Audible version, which is me reading it, which is, I think, quite good fun. Ideal for anyone you know who's got the slightest whiff of Second World War interest.
I mean, that is a lot of blokes that listen to this podcast.
I know. Come on, lads.
I'm thinking. Al, thanks so much for coming on the show. Hopefully see you soon.
Total pleasure. Thanks, Jeff.
Okay, that was... I just loved that chat. Could have gone on for ages, but Al, you know, he's a busy man. I appreciate him coming back on. I think Pints and Prejudice, the fact that he just thought that off the top of his head... He's just a comic genius. You know what I mean? His ability to ad lib. You know, I was properly laughing throughout that chat. And the fact that he can also turn his hand to history. So before it seems like I'm climbing too far up his arse, just buy the book. It's a really good book. And that was totally genuine what I said about getting it for a relative and enjoying reading it myself. There are no new reviews to read out. So if you do enjoy the podcast, if times are tricky financially, if there's one thing you could do, if you could do me a solid, is this. Go on, leave a 5-star review on iTunes or wherever you get your podcast and recommend it to a friend. And look, as I say, you know, with the World Cup, it's tricky, isn't it? Because morally it's fucked, but there's not much else happening in November, is there? So let's hope that if the World Cup is going to be morally fucked, that at least we can win. If we win it, will there be like an asterisk after it? England did eventually win a World Cup again, but it was the morally fucked one. Anyway, look, have a good week. I'll see you next week.
Legends, the greatest social casino experience has arrived at Legends.com. With thousands of the best free-to-play casino-style games, chances to earn millions of bonus coins and win real money. Legends is revolutionizing the Vegas experience wherever you are. If you love winning, then you'll love playing at Legends.com. Legends is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Play responsibly. Visit Legends.com for more information. Legends with a Z.com is legendary fun.